This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Show me the science with Professor Luke O'Neill.
Hello, Luke O'Neill here, and welcome to Show Me the Science, my weekly podcast. Can't wait to get cracking on this one, actually, and I keep coming across fascinating stories. And what I try to do, actually, is, first of all, requests. Now, happy to take them. L.A. O'Neill, with two L's, at tcd.ie. I have 15, actually, in the mix, and I will be going through some of those in the coming weeks. So please do email me if you want me to cover anything, hopefully to do with stuff I might know something about. Very happy to do that. But often then I see something in the news, and recently there was an incredible story about transplantation. So we're going to discuss now the science of transplantation. And the reason it's in the news is a woman gave birth to a baby from a transplanted womb, or uterus is the technical term for this. And when I saw that, my jaw dropped. I thought, can you imagine for a minute? They managed to transplant a womb into a woman, and the woman had a baby, came to term, and was born from that transplanted womb. Now, it's a big achievement for medical science. It had been done before, and it's not the first time it's been done, it must be said, but certainly the way this was done was highly successful. And what doctors are inclined to do, and surgeons, get the protocol optimized. And they reckon with this latest baby being born, they've optimized a way for women to have a womb transplanted into their bodies and then allows them to have a baby. And it's a joyous thing. And the mother, Grace, her name is Grace, she gave birth to a baby boy called Hugo. And she said, this is simply a miracle. Can you believe it? Now, she was born without a womb. Strangely, anatomical issue there, I guess. But she did have ovaries, so she could make eggs, but she had no womb. And of course, that gave rise to the possibility of surrogacy. And she and her partner thought about that, get the eggs out, fertilize them, and then have a surrogate mother. And that would have been an option for her. But then she was given the option. And it's quite brave of her, I think, in a way, that they were going to transplant a womb into her body, and then they could fertilize the egg with IVF. And then instead of the egg going into a surrogate mother, it could be in her own body. And that's exactly what happened here. And she gave birth to a bouncing baby. Hugo was born. And the woman who donated, if you will, or her family actually donated the womb, they are delighted as well, you see. And Grace herself said to them, I hope you can find some peace. You lost your daughter, but now you've given me the biggest gift of my life with this. So it's a wonderful story in terms of transplantation. And I will come back to the joy of this business of donating organs is really, really important. Now, the operation took 10 hours. This is the transplantation. 10 hours. Amazing long operation. It was done in Oxford in the Churchill Hospital. And there was a very important guy who was part of it, a man by the name of Richard Smith. Now, he had spent 25 years trying to achieve this. He was a transplant surgeon who specifically was trying to help and have wombs transplanted. And he observed it and he lent a hand, I guess. And to thank him, Grace gave Hugo second name Richard, naming him after Richard Smith, the kind of pioneering surgeon, if you will, who devised some of the early work on this. And that's quite a nice recognition for Richard as well. Now, let's look at transplantation, though, as an area, because obviously it was a big achievement to transplant a womb. The very first organ transplantation on record was 1954 in Boston, and it was identical twins, and one twin gave the other twin a kidney. And one twin had kidney failure and they needed to have a donation of a kidney. Now, before this, that twin was on dialysis the whole time, which is a very troublesome thing, hours and hours a day of dialysis. So the twin, of course, the identical twin, this worked because they had the same genetics. Now, remember, the number one problem with transplantation is your immune system will reject a foreign organ. It sees it as foreign, obviously. And there are special genes called MHC genes, which were discovered to be part of the rejection process. That stands for the major histocompatibility complex. The word histo means tissue. So the tissue has to be compatible, and there's genes that mark the tissue as being yours and not someone else's. And that's how those genes were found. They were found by transplant people. Now, they realised that skin transplants were the first place this was seen, and they were getting rejected. And then they realised, oh, it's these MHC genes. If you get those matched up, you won't reject the skin. It won't be seen as foreign. Now, this is important for immunology. What's happening here is the MHC is showing bits of the tissue to the immune system, and it's being recognised. And it was a bit of a puzzle. Like that didn't evolve. We weren't doing transplantations a million years ago. So the question is, what did the MHC genes actually do? Their day job is to present bits of virus, actually, and indeed bits of bacteria. So they did that as well. So they also present foreign stuff, and that's their main job. And then they also, sadly, also will present some of your own tissues, and quite how that evolved isn't clear. But their main job is to allow the immune system to recognise viruses and bacteria. But they're the very thing that are being recognised by the immune system when you reject a tissue. Now, what this means is, if you have a sibling, they will have very similar genes to you. So you'll probably have a match in the MHC. Identical twins are 100% identical, obviously. But even strangers can have an MHC similar to you. And they're the organs that can be used then to transplant them into someone's body. The trouble is, it's very hard to find matches unless you have a sibling prepared to give up a kidney or whatever it is. So there's a massive need for donor organs, and there's a massive shortage, which I'll come back to a little bit later. But certainly in the case of Grace, she put her hand up and said, I'm happy to have a go at this. And they found a woman who sadly had passed away, whose MHC was compatible with Grace's, and then that was the womb that was transplanted, and it didn't get rejected, obviously, because she was unable to have a baby. And they realised this in the 50s. The matching of the MHC was critical, still very difficult to achieve. And even if there is a match, it mightn't be 100%, and then the immune system gets stuck in and rejects the tissue. A major advance happens in the 1980s with the discovery of immunosuppressant drugs. And a drug called cyclosporin is discovered. It's actually from a fungus, strangely, it's where it first was found. And again, almost randomly, doctors show this can suppress the immune system. It targets a thing called mTOR, which is a key part of the immune system. Overall, that pathway gets targeted by this thing. There's a family of drugs that are like it, really, and they're often called mTOR inhibitors. Another one's called rapamycin. Cyclosporin actually hits a thing called calcineurin. But overall, we know how they work. They've been studied hugely. They take out T cells, and T cells are a key thing in your immune system that will reject an organ or indeed fight a virus or whatever it is. So cyclosporin gets discovered. That revolutionises transplantation because it massively increases the chance that the organ won't be rejected. And what's very important here is that when the organ is put in, let's say it's a kidney transplant, it's the first few hours are critical. That's when the immune system will go ballistic. So they give the people a very high dose of cyclosporin, transiently, really high dose. Now, it's worth the risk because you're going to sustain the tissue, and then you get over that initial attack. Now, the trouble is you got to keep taking cyclosporin, and that's a problem sometimes for people. There's a risk of cancer, for instance, for people on immunosuppressants. And as you may remember from the pandemic, anybody on immunosuppressants were at risk from SARS-CoV-2 because their immune systems weren't fully active, obviously, and they had to be especially careful. They still do. You'll see people, and we must always support them, wearing masks in airports. They're often on immunosuppressants, remember, because their immune systems have been ramped down, more than likely because they've had a transplant, because you're inclined to have to take these for a long time to sustain the organ that's been transplanted. Now, the discovery of that, and when I was a postdoc in Cambridge, some of the pioneering work was done at Addenbrooke's Hospital, and there was a great celebration. I was there in the 80s, and I remember the headlines, you know, cyclosporin working to help people with transplants. And pretty quickly, they can do transplants for kidney, liver, even heart and lung. Now, they're two huge organs to transplant. The first heart transplant was done in South Africa by Christian Barnard, and that didn't last very long. They didn't have immunosuppressants then. But now it's much more feasible to do the huge, big transplantation operations with those tissues. The tricky bit is the lungs and the heart are very complex organs, and they can cause all kinds of rejection issues anyway and irritations. So that it's hard to do those kinds of transplants. They've cracked the kidney and liver. They're still the most successful transplants. And liver transplantation happens because you might have hepatitis that's destroyed your liver, or indeed you might sadly be an alcoholic and they need transplants as well. So those are the kidney and liver are two of the most successful, but as I say, heart and lung is also there. And then this, the womb one, amazing, you know, another organ being transplanted. And one people may have seen, a face transplant was done. And they're able to transplant faces now for people who've been injured. And you can get a face now, attached. And that can take, if you have the immunosuppressants there as well. Now, there has been progress beyond the immunosuppressants. That was the big breakthrough. A big trick here is, and sadly, what normally happens is someone's in an accident, like a car crash or whatever, and then their organs are available. I'll come back to how that happens in a minute. The trick is to get the organ out quick, because if the body is dead for too long, that organ will become damaged. So remove the kidney, say, and they got very good at preserving the organ. Initially, they would cool it down. I thought that was a good idea. It's a bit like, you know, to stop it going off, you might think, in a strange way. So to stick it on ice or whatever, that turns out to be damaging. And that damages the tissue. When it goes in the body, then it's irritating to the body. Now they've got special solutions. They can perfuse the tissue, is the name they use for this. They keep it warm. They keep it at room temperature, and that seems to sustain. It's keeping it alive is the idea, I suppose, if it's in the body. And it's very high tech. I mean, looking at what they're doing here with the solutions, they're pumping through the organs, and that's got much more effective. So now, as I say, the success rate has gone up, partly because of that organ preservation. What's also interesting is there's a massive shortage of organs, which I'll come back to. And they don't want to transplant, say, a kidney from a 70-year-old who's died, because that kidney may not work. All these technologies are preserving older organs. They're called marginal donors, is the word they use for this. And in fact, one of my companies, we were trying to come up with a way to allow marginal organs to be preserved. It didn't work in the end, our technology. But still, if you can get an older organ to be useful, then that will increase the number of organs available. And these sort of technologies of perfusing and so on, they're allowing older donors to allow their organs to be available, and they might actually work. So that's another advance. We're increasing the number of organs that might be available. Now, the two frontiers, though, as well, that are very exciting. Can you believe you can now 3D print an organ? Now, this sounds a bit strange, but they're able to take cells and they're able to put them through a special printing device into a scaffold that might be made of a connective tissue material, and you're recreating an organ then through a printing mechanism. Isn't that incredible? And this has been done with the pancreas. It's been done with the kidney. They aren't there yet. They're gradually getting there. You're basically taking cells and turning them into an organ. And the 3D printer is used to get the right shape, because the kidney has a specific shape and the shape is important to how it functions. So 3D printed organs is a frontier that's coming, and there's one or two successes there so far. And the second area where there's been remarkable success lately is called xenotransplantation. This is using pig organs. Now, it might sound a bit unusual, and people are squeamish about this to some extent, but pigs are being used. Now, why would you pick pigs? Well, first of all, they did think about using chimpanzees and non-human primates, but that's ethically challenging. And that got banned, actually, in America. It was problematic because you don't want to be taking the kidney out of a chimpanzee, necessarily. I mean, we kill pigs and eat them, if you know what I mean. These non-human primates are our cousins, is the way to think of it. The second risk was they harbour viruses, some of those non-human primate organisms, and those viruses get into the body then. So they've banned all that. The pig, on the other hand, now why would you pick pigs? Interestingly, we are similar to pigs with our immune systems. We're closer to pigs than we are, say, to mice or rats with our immune systems. And that's good, because it's all about immune, avoiding immune rejection. And secondly, the pig is the same size as us, so the kidney is almost the same size as a human kidney. So they began trying this using pig organs, but again, rejection. This is a different species, remember. They eventually crack what to change in the pig organ to stop the immune system seeing it. Proteins on the surface of the organs in pigs, they're called glycoproteins, and they're the ones that are really triggering this acute rejection. So what are they doing? Gene editing. And amazingly, they're going into pig tissues now. They're using CRISPR, this famous gene editing technology, to chop out these genes that will trigger an immune response. So the current protocol is quite, you know, elaborate. You edit the pig's organ by removing the genes that are going to turn on the immune system, and that increases the chance that the pig organ will survive and not be rejected by the recipient's immune system. So gene-edited pigs. They're also deleting some viruses, because pigs do have certain viral elements in their DNA, and they might erupt and infect you. So again, they're editing out the viruses that are present latently. latent viruses in the pig organ as well. So now they've got a very elaborate way to take a pig organ and use gene editing. And again, successes are coming. Now, if this continues, the worry about trying to find donors will be less because we can use pigs as the source of the organs. And I've got a few examples for you. The very first one that was done, again, it was the kidneys. And they were, often the kidney is the first place to go because of the big need for the kidneys. And they use pig organs. And the longest someone is, if someone's still alive, over a year they've survived. His name is Tim Andrews. And he was transplanted back in 2025, January 25. And he's still alive. And we're a year out from him. And he was on death's door. His kidneys had failed. He was on dialysis. He was in big trouble. A second patient around the same time was also given a pig organ. And he lasted about 3 months. But his son turned up at a conference on xenotransplantation to thank all the surgeons. He said, "You gave me dad for 3 extra months. And his dad was literally, you know, on the way out because of massive kidney failure. So even though it's only 3 months, the son was very appreciative. But Andrews is now setting the record, and he's been alive now with his transplanted kidney now for over a year. So, and again, that's a gene edited pig kidney that was put into Tim Andrews' body. So very elaborate science here using gene editing, really benefiting people in that way. They've also done a heart xenotransplantation from a gene-edited pig heart. It was a 57-year-old was the recipient, and he survived for 49 days. And then another one, again, survived 2 months. And that was, again, the son was very grateful. The relatives are often very grateful, obviously, for this because they're getting a bit longer with their relatives. And again, the son in that case also was highly appreciative of what happened there. So we're seeing progress with this. The hope is this will continue. You'd hope eventually that they'll crack it even more. I mean, the reason why the heart and kidney might be getting rejected eventually, these people are very sick when they have the surgery and they're barely hanging on, you know, and then eventually they're going to sadly pass away. So if we can do it earlier, when they aren't quite so sick, maybe they will be able to sustain the transplanted organ more effectively. If you combine it with immunosuppressants, as I've been mentioning, and there's all new ones being tested as well, by the way, not just cyclosporin, it's been replaced by even more elaborate immunosuppressants. This will increase the chance of pig organs being sustained, and also any organ transplantation anyway. Now, as I say, there's a big need for organ donors, and at the moment, I've looked it up, there's over 700 people in Ireland on the waiting list. 2/3 of those are waiting for a kidney. Now, remember, these people are on dialysis for hours and hours. It's a hugely debilitating thing. Kidney transplant would sort them out. So there's a list, and gradually, of course, they're going through the list. And as I say, mainly from traffic accidents and so on is where the kidneys are coming from. So we need donors. And Ireland changed its policy on this. It used to be you had to opt in. So you filled in a little card. You said, I'm happy to have my organs being done or whatever, used after I die. Now you don't have to opt in anymore. It's a different thing. The default is, the assumption would be that your organs can be used. And this is called a soft opt-out, is the name they give to this. Now, the relatives still need to give permission. So if you are listening and you haven't got a card on your body or whatever about organ transplantation, the assumption is your organs are available, provided that your relatives are happy for them to be used. That makes sense, because some people don't like this for various reasons, or they may have religious reasons or whatever. But at the moment, Ireland has this soft opt-out scheme. So by default, your organs could well be used. And that brings me back to Grace, because she was the woman who got the womb transplant. And that woman who died gave Grace her womb. She gave 5 other organs to people post-mortem, obviously, after she died, you know. And here was a woman then who had been, tragically, was died in an accident, I think it was. And lo and behold, 6 of her organs are in people now and benefiting those people massively, you know. And of course, the beautiful thing about this is her family have said that she has managed to give other families the precious gift of time, hope and new life. And what a wonderful thing that is. So I think it's a lesson to us all in some ways, how the impact this can have on people if you donate organs after, sadly, after you've passed away. And I think the future will be more and more donors are needed, and the immunosuppressants are working well, so that's more than likely it's going to work. But also the 3D printed organs, and then ultimately maybe pig organs that have been engineered genetically to be able to be used in transplantation, that will continue into the future. So the whole business of transplantation then there is optimism that eventually anybody who needs an organ in terms of being donated as a recipient should be able to get it, is the big dream, of course, ultimately. Cost will come into it inevitably, which we worry about. But we're heading in the right direction where these lists and lists of people waiting for a donor to give them a precious organ, that shouldn't be a feature because it should be available, you know, through these various technologies. And I think the story of the transplanted womb is a beautiful story that illustrates this perfectly. So there you have it, the science of transplantation. And thanks for listening as ever. And my podcast is a News Talk production, available every Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.